Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 493. Hey, I'll be performing at Caroline's in New York May 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. So come on out to that. You can go to Caroline's website or nerdist.com/calendar. We will be doing At Midnight Live at the South Beach Comedy Festival April 4th. And I think we're doing a couple dates around. Maybe I think we're doing an At Midnight in Nashville. So there's tons of live stuff going on. Nerdist.com/calendar. I'd like to thank NatureBox.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. If you want healthy, amazing snacks delivered almost right to your mouth, go to naturebox.com. I cannot guarantee that the postal carrier will put it directly in your mouth, but I don't know. Strike a deal. You know, they're people. Why not? See what happens. NatureBox is a subscription service starting at $19.95 where you can discover and enjoy really healthy snacks on a monthly basis, and each bag is full size. It's got like 3 to 5 servings of snack food in it, so you're not going to get like a tiny bag with a couple of things and then feel ripped off. That's not how they work. NatureBox is a great company, and they want to give you healthy, delicious snacks. So then that way, you don't have to drive around the city and then go, hey, I'm hungry. I'm going to go put a bunch of unhealthy things in my body because I don't know what I'm going to eat again. Carry some healthy snacks around with you, and then just throughout the day, snack at your leisure. Thanks to NatureBox. There's a coupon code, 50% off your first box at naturebox.com. That's only $9.95. And an incredible variety of snacks. So, just go to naturebox.com/nerdist. Thanks for sponsoring the Nerdist Podcast. Which is Jared Leto, Oscar winner Jared Leto. But we recorded this when he was Oscar nominee Jared Leto. But a really, really, really great chat. We never met before, but we, you know, we tweeted each other back and forth, which is a thing that happens now. That's how you meet people. Twitter is essentially like a friend service, I've discovered, and also a great way to get guests on the podcast. But he is, this guy, Jared's busier than I am. I don't know how he does it, but he's just like flew in for a couple days, came into the podcast, flew back. I don't know where in the world he is right now, but he is promoting his short film documentary City of Angels about his band 30 Seconds to Mars, which is available on Vimeo.com. But we had a really great chat, and it was nice to sit down with him. And so also nice to see like where his head was at going into the Oscars. And then now, of course, man, it seemed like everyone knew he was going to win. But still, it's probably pretty rad to win an Oscar. I will never know. And I'm fine with that. But here's the Nerdist Podcast number 493 with the delightful Jared Leto.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I just haven't had a chance to eat today.
So I'm not surprised. I'm surprised you... I think at this... With all this shit that's happening in your life right now, there should just be a thing where you could just put like a protein patch on your neck.
A gel.
Or a gel.
Like an ultra marathoner. You just squeeze a gel and they push you into the next meeting.
And then you just absorb... Your body just absorbs nutrients. It will completely take the joy out of eating.
I'm on board. I would like the joy removed from eating.
Oh, buddy.
It's so joyful.
Come here.
No, it's okay.
I love you.
I did read it. My brother read an article to me recently about, you know, the difference between eating because you're hungry and eating for pleasure, right? And the psychology of that and why certain foods make us go nuts. Like, I guess in nature, there's not a combination of salt, sugar, and fat.
Okay.
So when we have something that has salt, sugar, and fat, we just go absolutely fucking
so
nuts.
So everything in the American diet?
Let me tell you, this weekend in San Francisco, I went to this place called Sweet Maple. I'll plug it because it was delicious.
Ooh, yum. Yeah. Sounds good.
It's called Millionaire's Bacon.
Oh, I heard about Millionaire's Bacon.
I was like, well, I better order this. It's a very thick slice of bacon that is like a maple glaze on it with some sugar on it.
Oh,
top.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly
they have that at the Clinton
talking.
Street Bakery in New York. If you ever go to the Clinton Street Bakery in New York, they have sugar bacon.
It's not called Millionaire's Bacon, is
and,
it?
And it gets me – it's like the kind of food that you get fucking mad at where you're like, why are you so good? Like I get mad. I get mad at bacon.
Well, my plane almost crashed yesterday. But the good thing about it is we made an emergency landing in the middle of Colorado, and we ended up at a restaurant called Bin 70 or something.
How'd you go from almost crashing to a casual lunch?
Still gotta eat, buddy.
It was a casual late dinner. It was the only restaurant. Emma found it on Yelp, and it was one of the best restaurants. I don't know if it was because we just survived a near-death experience, but
It was the most amazing food ever.
What happened?
I shouldn't talk about it.
Okay.
It was brutal and weird and intense. And we just had a really dangerous thing happen, and we had to make an emergency landing.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
But on the
anyway,
bright side
on another,
things, they
another
went to
thing,
a wonderful
yeah,
restaurant.
We got the best food you could ever
I
imagine.
Like that you found the silver lining in that. Mm-hmm. I love that you found the silver lining in that story somehow. And then yet still, after that, we're like, okay, let's go get on a plane again.
That's it. And a couple hours, we were on the plane. Sorry, I'm eating.
That's okay. You need to eat. This is a very crazy... Everything that's happening in your life right now is insane. First of all, I watched the movie last night, and it is fucking amazing. Thank I mean, so like... So, I mean, it's, you know, like, I don't see every movie all the time just because of my work schedule. I work 7 days a week, and so... But I really wanted to see it before you came on, and it really, like, everyone in the movie was so, and you were fucking amazing.
Thank
God
so
damn
much.
It. It was like the sugar bacon. It was the sugar bacon of movies.
It was the millionaire bacon.
It was really millionaire's bacon, of movies.
I appreciate that.
We sort of, I feel like we've tweeted at each other before a little bit. Like, oh, you come to the podcast, and you're like, sure, and then our schedules just...
Yeah, good problems.
Did that. Yeah, really good problems.
Yeah.
So between when are you acting and when are you performing music
I hadn't made a movie in almost 6 years and I hadn't read a script in actually years before Dallas Buyers Club came my way. I read it. I fell in love. I had a feeling I wanted to make another film to see if there was anything left in that world for me. I love film. I love so much about it. I was a film student for a while and dropped out in my third year to pursue acting because I thought if I got a job acting, I could get a job as a director. So that was actually the beginning
for
me.
You're not wrong.
Yeah, it's kind of worked in a way because I spent a lot of time behind the camera over the past 10 years, just put out a documentary. It's on iTunes now called Artifact, but we can get back to that later. But I guess I've been spending a lot of time with 30 Seconds to Mars around the world. And, you know, we were signed in 1998. Something impossible happened. We succeeded, much to everyone's disappointment, or many people's disappointment.
Well, they don't want you to succeed because, I mean, some people don't want you to succeed. They're like, no, because in their heads, you're in a certain box.
Of course.
Right? And so they're like, and you've had, it's sort of funny, you've had a lot of these luxury boxes to get out of. It's like, he's too attractive. How could he be a good actor? Oh, all right, he's a good actor. Well, he's an actor. How could he be in a band? All right, the band's pretty good. You know, it's like, it's constantly changing what people's expectations are.
I mean, I think that's not such a bad thing. And, you know, I've always just been in the business of making dreams happen, whether they're small and or big ones like that. And I think that we're probably all of us sitting around the table have that in common, you know, or else we wouldn't be here sitting in front of microphones. So I've been spending a lot of time with that. And, you know, I made this little movie in last December. And somehow, some way, it connected with people, and they responded to what we did. And now it's just been an amazing journey. I'm actually on tour right now and stopped in L.A. for a few days just to do a few things, visit you.
That was very nice of you.
I was at the Oscar luncheon today, and they're rushing
me out.
Take
the big
picture? Yeah, I took the big picture. Someone got a picture of me. I was really tired because of the near-death experience. It's really draining when
you
almost
die. That
does
take a lot out of you.
And the triple fried bacon and all that. But someone got a picture of me yawning too. In the middle of the group, you know, it was a buddy who had sent it to me. I'm sure it's going to be all over the place.
And that's going to be one of those things where people are like, oh, what an asshole. Yeah, how could it? And you're like, no, you guys, I haven't slept in like 4 days. Like,
yeah.
I feel like people don't ever want to assume the human thing about you.
Yeah,
they always want to assume the asshole thing about you. And we're like, no, I've been working a lot.
Yeah, no, I'm an asshole. It's okay to assume that. No, that's what's funny about it. I've been doing this for a really long time now. So I've obviously had a chance to adjust to all of it in a really good way. I think I never had an explosive career. I've had a career that's been, you know, one foot in front of the other, and sometimes things work wonderfully like they are now, or with 30 Seconds to Mars, and you look around and you'd be like, wow, we're touring the world for the seventh time and playing some of the biggest venues on the planet, and it's amazing and wonderful, and I guess a testament to what's possible, to hard work.
I guess.
When I think we were at MTV at the same time.
Yeah, that's why I know you. That's where you got famous, isn't it?
Not really.
What were you doing at MTV? Yeah,
I was doing Singled Out, but yeah. I don't think. I know
your face from those days. I guess originally that was the first imprint. It's like a coin, though.
Well, we're exactly the same age. We're exactly the same age.
Really?
And I gotta say, I think people should be hopeful for us being the age that we are, because I feel like we're kind of been good.
Yeah, I mean, he looks a little better.
He looks way better. I mean, there's not even a little bit. It's not even a little bit. But I think that when we were younger and we sort of thought of like, oh, what is 42 like?
Oh, yeah,
you know,
for
like,
sure.
Oh, that's, I think of like, oh, by that time you're in your pajamas at 4 p.m.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly. And it's nice to know there's still some life left.
There's a lot left.
I just went snowboarding for 4 days and it was like, I was boarding better than I've ever in my life and felt in better shape than I've ever felt up there in my life. And that we boarded one day with a guide, and he was 53, and the guy was so nuts. He was boarding with one of his feet out of the board the whole time through the trees in the powder.
Show off.
And just so incredible and inspiring. I'm just glad that 70 is the new 20.
Let's keep saying that. Yeah, it's not over.
The new 12.
Do you have this thing where you go,
the more money you have, the more decades you can buy.
I have a lot of faith in science that by the time I'm 70, reverse aging. I'm hoping.
It kind of happens because you start wearing a diaper again. People have to help you go to the bathroom.
I don't want to jump that far back. I want to go back to the 20. I don't want to go that far back. Yeah. But I had read in an interview that you said that that the time that you took off was really valuable to you because these 6 years gave you wisdom and just basically gave you experiences that helped the acting part that you wouldn't have had if you had just kept.
Yeah. I think it's a similar thing. It's like if you went on a journey, you went on an adventure, and you came back and you saw your friends after 6 years, you'd have something to say. Yeah. It's the same thing for an artist. Whether you're a painter, or you're a musician, or you're an actor, or you interview people, you know, and tell stories, whatever it is, you really only have to offer that which you've consumed, you've mm-hmm. taken in. So it was a productive and good time, a time to grow up, a time to have a lot of failure, some successes. And, you know, the failure teaches you quite a bit. And we saw things we never dreamed of before.
Did you feel like when you left for the 6 years, were you like, I'm tapped out, I got to take a break?
I just had a very full life and still do, really busy. So I wasn't pining for other creative fulfillment. I didn't feel like, oh, I'm missing out. Yeah. I was making tons of music videos in front of the camera, behind the camera, spending a lot of time editing and directing and producing and, you know, making this documentary, which is about our battle with our former record company. They sued us for $30 million. And we fought them for 2 years and filmed everything. Jeez.
Oh, wow.
So, and that just came out. And that's been another real highlight in the past few months. It's funny, Julie Roberts came up to me at the, it's great, you can say Julie Roberts' name. Everyone goes, their chin comes up a little, excuse me, what'd you say?
Julie Roberts.
Julia. By the way, I was with Bono earlier, just dropping some names, and Merrill.
Merrill Lynch?
Oh, yes, exactly, yeah. Merrill Lynch. They gave me a great deal on a new loan. So I was at the Golden Globes and Julie Roberts comes up and she's like, oh, the film is so amazing. This is just so incredible. The story was wonderful. And I mean, Artifact was so great. And for sure, I thought she was talking about Dallas Buyers Club. But you know, it's been nice because the film is really, you don't have to be a fan or even interested in 30 Seconds of Mars. It's about art and commerce. Like, you guys would watch it and be like, you know, I've had a similar scenario because I'm a creative person and I've dealt with the ugly side of business and how that can infringe or create a lot of friction for a creative person. So it's nice that the film is getting that kind of response. It won the Toronto Film Festival Documentary Award and Gotham Documentary Award as well.
Well, yeah, because that's right about the – that's like if you started in 99 – that was kind of the beginning of the end for the traditional music industry anyway. Yeah. So that was a very strange, unfortunately for you guys, that was a strange time to get in with a label.
We're very lucky that we started so early. I mean, because there's a lot of what we have now that I don't know if we could have accomplished now. It's a different time in every way, the consumer behavior and the business of music. But we're a band. We've sold 10 million albums.
Jesus.
We've played in front of 100,000 people shows. You know, we sell out the O2 Arena and Hollywood Bowl. You know, but still, we ended up in a situation where, although we sold millions of albums, we were millions of dollars in debt.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think that, wait, that's not going to happen to us. So we examined that, and I'm excited for other artists and young people to see how this business really works and what they can do to avoid it.
Well, basically, in that situation, I would assume it's just the label basically just expenses you for everything, and you pay for every single thing, and you can almost never make up for it unless you're the top 0.001% of...
You're exactly right. Yeah. Until there's so much money that they just can't even... They can't even... Even with the help of an acting coach, they can't tell you you're in debt. They just are, you know, you sold 50 million albums. Now, you know, maybe if you sold 30, they'd still try to say you're in debt. But once you get to those big, big numbers, they got to write you
people
a check.
Started getting hip to that with the TLC Behind the Music.
Yes.
Where they basically just came out and said, like, yeah... So Chili or one of them basically just walks through the math of it and goes, so if they say you made this amount of money, this is where all this comes out, and then they charge you for this, and then on top of this, and then you have to pay all these different, and then you're, so she was explaining, like, how could we be broke if we were this famous?
The other thing that people don't understand is the way that some of the streaming services and even the YouTube deals work. You know, the record companies get giant advances, you know, those advances aren't necessarily shared with the artists. You know, they go to the record companies so they can make sure that they have the right to stream music, they have right to broadcast music videos. But at the end of the day, it's rare that artists get paid anything at all from a lot of the streaming services. So there's still a lot of room for improvement as far as, you know, artists and record labels and how deals are made. The dumb thing is they could make very transparent deals, simple deals, and still make tons of profit and keep people really happy. They could treat musicians like entrepreneurs, people like Mark Zuckerberg or Steve Jobs, who took on VC money in order to build their businesses. But could you imagine if those people were treated or had convoluted, strange contracts that, you know, are impossible to read unless you're a mathematician, you wouldn't have Apple. You wouldn't have Facebook. Some people just sighed. Oh, thank God. But you wouldn't have some of these wonderful things that we have in our lives.
Well, the commerce side is, I mean, especially if you're just a career, if it's like, oh, I just want to, it's almost like, there should almost be a, you know, if there is like a performance arts school, there should be a business side of the performance arts school.
Yeah, I'm good with a dick joke, but terrible with money.
But if you just want to tell your dick joke, imagine you're just like, I just want to tell dick jokes. And then someone was like, well, here's a bunch of ways that you can do
and then
that.
I get to a point where now I've told so many dick jokes that someone's like, now I need a business manager to help me with my dick joke money.
Yeah. It does happen.
What the fuck am I going to
do? Penis can equal a lot of cash.
Apparently, I am learning, guys. I'm loaded.
Yes, in many ways.
So this 6 years, did you take any time
touring
off?
Incessantly?
You were just touring
nonstop. We toured. So this is kind of ridiculous and funny, but kind of fun and cool as well. We toured so much on our last album, we broke the Guinness World Record for the longest tour ever. And they came on stage and gave us a plaque in New York.
Who did you beat?
Some English guy in a yellow jacket.
Oh.
He was great. And now I have got that plaque proudly sitting in my guest bathroom above my guest toilet.
May I come over and pee?
You can.
Thank you.
And you can piss in awe. That we've played.
That's the best thing to put in your fucking bathroom.
Right?
The world record. You're just peeing and staring at a world record.
This guy broke a record.
It's unbelievable.
So I have a question for you, just as being as someone who is who works a lot too. Do you feel like you're running from anything to stay that busy, or is it just the joy of, oh, this is just something I love so much that I never want to stop it?
I'm sure there's some deep-seated adolescent psychological, you know, painful, impactful experience that may have generated some of the desire to win, to please, you know, the world. But I think also there's joy in the accomplishment, the achievement of goals and dreams. And once you've felt that, it's hard to not want to pursue it. And therein lies a little bit of danger, too,
sure.
Because you win in one area, win in the other, and you kind of get into not so much the innovator's dilemma, but another dilemma that even corporations face all the time. you know, diversify too much, and they don't do a good job with what they're supposed to do.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, like,
so Microsoft, the investors are telling the new CEO,
yeah,
drop the Surface, drop Xbox, yeah, and just focus on software.
That's Unix philosophy. Yeah. Like, do,
but
one
it's hard
thing
to let go
well,
because yeah, you get Microsoft, yeah, you got Xbox.
Yeah.
So there's an example of, oh, okay, we can get into a world and a place, a vertical that can be incredibly lucrative and maybe help push our business in a new direction. But I think as far as being busy all the time, you know, you, I always tell young people when they come and ask for advice or they're talking about creative things, you have to be compelled beyond a reasonable doubt to do this. Because if you're not, it's not worth it. It's not pain. It's too painful. It's not stable enough to put up with what needs to be put up with. You should just do something normal, you know, for lack of a better term, because the uncertainty and instability is too great.
Yeah.
So don't do it unless you're compelled. Like, I want to do this with my life. I'm happy to work a Sunday.
Sure.
Tuesday is the same as Saturday to me. Mm-hmm. But you have to be compelled beyond a reasonable doubt to do these sorts of things, or else they're not worth doing.
Well, I would say you have to enjoy, you have to greatly enjoy the process.
Yeah.
Good or bad, you have to enjoy the process, because the goal achievement, the attainment of a goal is so fleeting, really. I mean, it's like, oh, I did that. Oh, that's weird. And I think it fucking blows a lot of people's brains out of the side of their head, because they're like, oh, what now? That was a thing. And now, yeah, I'm left. What am I supposed to? And so I think you really have to just use them as sort of like, you know, like, oh, that's
plates, spinning plates.
Yeah, well,
keep,
I guess,
like spinning plates.
But really, exactly, just a little bit of a roadmap to, yeah, because you don't really grow in the attainment process, in the attainment moment, you grow during the process. Like,
sure,
that's where
it's
all that
shit happens.
The
failure that teaches you as well.
Right.
You don't. When I was younger, maybe I would have think like I would have thought, once you succeed, then you're there and you can kind of take a breath. It doesn't happen like that. You know, that hamster wheel keeps turning a little bit faster. It's Sisyphus, right?
Yes.
You push the boulder to the top of the hill and it rolls back down again. But you know, there has to be something in that climb that's incredibly compelling and rewarding and fulfilling. And there is, you know. But I also bet a lot of people would probably stand in our shoes after a couple of weeks and say, you know what? You can have your job back.
You'd have to love it.
You have to be compelled beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, you have to love it. And I would add to Sisyphus, I would also add Tantalus, who was another punished in Hades guy who constantly... He was in a pool of water, and he was thirsty. And every time he would go for the water, it would disappear. So he could never have his thirst quenched.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like that's the same kind of like, you never, like, some people are so rabid to find this experience. It's like, this is going to be the thing that fixes everything, and they can never actually get it.
Terminal dissatisfaction is certainly a quality I've found in a lot of creative people.
Do you need it to be artistic, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think there are a lot of really, you know, adjusted people that have stable lives that make wonderful.
Besides Tom Hanks.
Thanks. besides Tom Hanks. Well, maybe not. I mean, Stephen King, I don't know.
I've sat next to him at some Red Sox games.
Okay.
He's an interesting character.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Did you talk to him?
Yeah.
What'd you talk about?
About Red Sox.
I'm surprised you didn't talk about Bangor, Maine.
Bangor,
Maine.
He's a lovely guy, Stephen King.
He is. He's great. So when this opportunity for the movie came up and you started doing it, did it feel, when you were doing it, did it feel like, oh, this feels extra special, or this is going to be something, or do you just not even think about that
stuff? I don't think I was in that place. I was so focused on building. It's really like anything else. If you're building a house or putting the bricks in the wall, you're so focused on the work at hand, and you know, you've got a deadline, you've got to deliver, you have to kind of do all of these tasks in order to get to where you need to go. You know, the heels and the tights and all of the accoutrements, the lipstick, all the physical things, and then there's the dialect and the register, and there's the losing 30, 40 pounds, there's the dialogue every day, in the scenes that you try to get inside and underneath so you understand why people are doing what they're doing. So there's a whole series. You become a detective and a psychologist, and it's eternally fascinating. thing to do. Shooting isn't very much fun because it's always a series of compromise. You never have enough time. You get up incredibly early, you know, 4 a.m., 4:30, go right to the makeup chair. You're putting, you know, cancer lesions on your body and all kinds of makeup to make you look ill because your character's dying. So a lot of it isn't the most enjoyable thing to do, but it's like those guys that climb Everest and they say it was miserable. I got to the top. I couldn't wait to get down. But, you know, they're compelled beyond a reasonable doubt to do it.
I mean, it's you know, a film like this runs the risk of being like really heavy handed, like, oh, OK, I get it. It's tragic and everyone's going to die. Sure. And in your death scene is really like it just happens quickly. Mm. And it almost kind of gives you the experience of like, well, that's how it would have been to McConaughey's character. Mm. Like it just fleeted by and just gone. Yeah.
I talked to people that were alive at that time, some people who were HIV positive at that time and are still alive by some miracle, living healthy, productive lives. And they said they had entire communities just wiped out, friendships, just their whole group of friends, everybody gone. And they're the only ones alive, you know. Could you imagine that? Your entire group of friends that you share your life with just disappeared. You can't stop it. Can't slow it down.
Well, it's very much sort of like apocalypse mythology. Like, you know, we're so fascinated now, our pop culture and horror movies, like we're so fascinated with apocalypse culture. It's like, oh, some virus wiped a bunch of people out. Yeah. That actually happened.
It actually
to
did.
To a section of humanity. That actually happened.
Yeah. And there's not a cure. You know, there are many people in the world, it's still a death sentence. You know, if you happen to be living in a place where you can, you know, either afford healthcare or have healthcare you know, offered to you, then you can live a life. But still, you know, millions of people, 35 million people are living with HIV/AIDS around the world. 36 million people have died from HIV/AIDS, from the disease, from AIDS. So it's still there. It's still alive and well.
Were you, was there any part when you did the film, were you afraid about any potential? Because obviously it's a very sensitive topic.
Yeah.
So, and because it's tragic and it's affected people in the worst way that you can imagine. So obviously taking on this material, there is a tremendous amount of responsibility on you to portray it in a way that is, you know, respectful and makes people feel like, oh, he understands it, which is very difficult because obviously you're healthy and, you know. So how, did you understand or did you feel any of the weight of that?
I met with people in the very beginning that were instrumental in coaching me and giving me the understanding that I need. I also had my own experiences in life where I moved to Los Angeles when I was young, and the first apartment that I rented after I got off, you know, I had a backpack and a couple hundred bucks in my pocket when I first came to LA. I was staying at like crack motels and the beach at Venice and a hostel down there. I remember I walked in this one hostel in Venice. I've never told this story, but I walked into one hostel. I looked at a few different hostels. I don't even think they probably have hostels there anymore. Maybe they do. But I went down there and I walked into the room. There's a guy just sitting naked on his bed and he looks up at me, says, "Hello. Would you like to have a seat?" I said, "I think I'll check another room out." He was very strange looking. And I always thought it was a bit much for him to be completely naked and welcome his roommate into.
You know why? Because if you're okay with that, then you're probably going to be an okay roommate.
Yeah, I guess so. He was very relaxed. But
it's like farting on the first date. If you still want to have a second date after that,
then you're really special.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think it was more his creepy voice than his nakedness that freaked me out. So anyway, I came here, and what were we talking about?
We came here just talking about the responsibility. You said
yes. I met with a boy. I had an experience early on where I rented a room in a 3-bedroom apartment, and one of the rooms was taken by a man in his 40s who was dying of AIDS. He was a gay man. And, you know, I watched week after week as he withered away. And, you know, he was funny and kind and very graceful. And there's certainly some piece of him that I instinctively put into Rayon. But that experience helped inform me a lot as well. I also lost my first agent to AIDS when I first moved out here. So, you know, I think so many of us have been confronted with AIDS or cancer, you know, and have known people in circumstances beyond their control that are fighting for their lives. So I think that's probably the reason the film resonates with a lot of people, too.
Did you take any of it home each night when you're shooting?
Hard to let go. When you're just physically, when you do that, it becomes muscle memory, those things. You know, obviously, you've lost a lot of weight. So it's not like go home and you eat a big meal.
Right.
You know, you carry all that with you. You know, I waxed my entire body, including my eyebrows. My face looked different. People treated me different. You know, I got lots of strange looks from people. You know, who is this person? What is this person? And so it was really tough to leave. It was a full-time job.
Yeah. I had read, you know, I'm sure a lot of people are asking you about this, so I apologize for being another person. But the thing that happened at the Santa Barbara Film Festival, where you were questioned by, you know, like, well, why should a straight man get to play someone from the transgender community, and I felt like, you know, I read, and you know, a really good friend of mine is in the trans community, and I don't feel like it was necessarily about you. I think it was about a bigger this bigger thing that's like, you know, why aren't we being represented? And because, again, I, you know, not being a part of the community, it's tough for me to say, but your performance was so fantastic in this movie. But I thought it was really interesting that, you know, rather than get defensive or rather be like, well, fuck, I'm an actor, what do you want, like, you engaged and apparently talked at length after the panel with the people who asked the questions. And so what was that conversation like, and what did it mean? Well,
I think it was a great conversation to have. You know, people don't always have access to make their voices heard, and other people may think it's inappropriate to take or feel like it's taking advantage of a situation to go to a public event or arena and kind of you know, make your voice heard in that way. But I think it's okay to have a debate. And that's what it was. I think that at the end of a debate, you know, interesting things happen. You become educated a little bit more. Your perspective may change about a particular topic. And in that case, I think it was a good conversation to have. I don't think it's a bad conversation to have, you know, this conversation about who should have the right to play any given part out there. You know, how do we create more opportunity for minorities, which is what that group is as well, you know, people that are in the minority. And I think that's an awesome thing to talk about. So I was happy to speak with those people afterwards. And, you know, I mean, it was reported as heckler, but I think a debater is a much more appropriate term. And I think it came from a really good place. I've gotten tons of support and you know, love from the LGBT community, from transgender people. But it's still worthy to have that conversation. I've got tons to learn. We've all got tons to learn. So I'm open. The door is open there. And I also think that, you know, what I said there remains true. You know, if you only gave people an opportunity to play the characters that they closest resembled in their own lives, it would probably be a pretty boring world. You know, you want to be able to stretch. You want to be able to be gay, lesbian, trans, and to play a straight person. You want to be able to play someone that's maybe not who you are all the time in your life. So I think that, you know, although it's a healthy conversation, I had my opinion about it too.
Well, I think it's important. I think it's an important lesson for people that, because when a lot of people think of debate, they usually, particularly in the way pop culture works now, it's just name-calling. It's like, I'd get to a certain point and be like, no, you shut up. And people get defensive. Yeah. But to see an example of like, this is something that I feel, let's gain a better understanding.
I think it was a totally positive interaction. And we all, I think, came away from it better off than if we had not had that. But yeah. Both myself and the people that were there that had something to say. And I think that's a good thing to happen. I'm totally open and glad that something like that happened.
Well, I think Rayon was from what I took away was that I think a lot of people could have played that character as like stereotypically gay, but she, she was just a, the character was just beautiful. Like the sexuality was, it was almost incidental. It was just a very beautiful character.
Well, I appreciate that. I think also in 1985, what people need to remember is that the word transgender wasn't being tossed around. You know, there was a scientist who used, or a psychologist who used the term in 1970-something, I think was the earliest that I could find it. But it wasn't a term that was tossed around, you know. And I think for Rayon, she was in a process of discovery. She was in a process of exploring identity. That's why she had a different wig on every fucking day, you know. And she was trying to figure out, who is she? Am I like the other guys that I know who just like to put on women's clothing?
Yeah.
Or do I want to live my life as a woman?
Yeah.
You know, I chose to make a decision. I made a decision early on to play her as someone who was born a man, but identified with living as a woman. But at that time, especially in Texas, I don't know if she had all the answers. I don't think she had all the information. You know, I think that she had feelings and she had desire, but you know, she didn't. There was no perfect solution at that time, and certainly not a lot of. There weren't many examples that she had out there to show her maybe where that solution was for her.
So how did that, so jumping over to 30 Seconds to Mars, how do you come out of an experience like this, which is going to change you and maybe give you perspective and understanding that you didn't have before and maybe make you more appreciative of life, I assume, and then just go back to like, okay, now I'm in tour mode again, now I'm in a band, now I'm Jared, and now I'm just...
Sure. Well, you know, all of these things change you. They teach you. You hope to keep a piece of what you love so much about the character. Like, she was such a dreamer and so sweet and funny. You hope that if I ever was faced with such dire circumstances, such challenging situation as she was, that I would have that much grace and charm and levity, you know, and be so courageous. So you hope to keep a few of those things. And she was very open. I could be super guarded. So you want to, you know, you hope that wow, if I could be like that way in a character or role, why can't I be like that in the rest of my life?
Well, because it's being open as yourself, you're vulnerable. And at least as a character, there's a layer of separation where you're like, oh, well, if some, you know, that's not me. I think it's great to play a good character, but I think it's really scary to be yourself. It's really scary to be yourself publicly because then you can be attacked as who you are.
Yeah. I think you're right. You know, I'm really proud that I was able to make this film and touch people with a performance that was sculpted from nothing, you know. It wasn't based on my charming and winning personality. It was based on, you know, the heart and soul of a person. That's something that's really wonderful. You know, I think it's a rare thing to be able to do. So I'm really happy about that.
So when do you go back on? Can you even think about going back on tour?
I'm already on tour.
You're on tour now. Oh, yeah. That's right. You're on tour now.
I just played 3 shows in Mexico.
Jesus.
Yeah, they were some of the biggest and best shows we ever played. Guadalajara, Monterrey, and Mexico City, DF. And we're headed to Lille and Lyon and Paris, 2 shows in Paris. Then we go to Sweden, Denmark, Finland, Norway, Germany, Austria.
All by train? Come on.
Copenhagen.
Oslo. And Brazil pretty soon. It was in Brazil, I think, it's just announced. Pretty excited. You're going to get the Brazilian family coming. Brazil in May. But we're all over the place. South Africa.
Yeah, you got to pop back for the Oscars and then
Italy.
Go back out and tour the world.
That's really
it's
what we're doing.
Pretty fucking sweet.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing. If you don't mind missing sleep, then it's okay.
You know, yeah, it is. It's I'm pretty good.
But I like to sleep.
I can't sleep more than like 5 hours. Like 5 hours is my, and if I wake up, then I have to go back. If I go back to sleep, I have like a weird sleep hangover the rest of the day.
Yeah.
But so just sort of wrap up, how did you get through it? What about you led you from being this young actor, you know, who very easily could have been, you know, ruined by Hollywood or ruined by the lifestyle, but, you know, being sort of the young, if coming from my so-called life to everything else that you've done, how did you get through it? How did you succeed and kind of...
Well, I was born really, you know, into, we didn't have a lot, you know, we were poor and it's all comparative. There were people living $1 a day. We lived on food stamps. and we were in America. So how poor, you know, are you comparatively? I lived in Haiti for a short time when I was a kid too. That's poor. You know, those people, the poor people in Haiti are some of the most challenged people on the planet. So we had our blessings and we were lucky to be where we were. But certainly, you know, we had a young single mom who wanted to make a better life for herself. And I think that although I came to Los Angeles after dropping out of art school to make films as an actor, to get a job as a director, I had other dreams. You know, I never really saw myself in a box. I didn't see myself as someone who had this one career path, and at the end of it, I'm going to get a watch and retire. I just don't have that kind of mentality. I've always been creative, and I've always just followed my gut. And I certainly wasn't going to let any preconceived notions or stereotypes stop me from pursuing my dream. I'm not going to do it because that person's making fun of me over there. Yeah, it would be the most absurd. If the world worked that way, it would be a really sad place. We wouldn't have a lot of the wonderful things that we have enjoyed on this planet. But, you know, I guess for me, there are a lot of things that I would love to do. I'm compelled beyond a reasonable doubt to, you know, do the things that I'm doing right now. We'll see what tomorrow brings. I haven't read another script since Dallas Buyers Club, but we'll see what happens.
Well, when you go back to your house, wherever your house is, I'm sure you probably don't get to see it very often, but it will be the one that has a buried in a mountain of scripts that you'll have to knock out of the way to get to your fucking door. But
just so you can pee in front of the Guinness Book of World Records for the longest tour.
But Jared, I know you have to go, but it was really lovely talking to you.
Yeah, it was awesome talking to you guys.
And travel safe.
Thank you.
Stay off death planes.
Thank you. Only took us a year or so, but we're here.
We're here, yeah.
We did it. So come back. Twitter's going to go crazy.
Thanks, man. It's good to see you.
You too.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
That's what I need. Yeah. A burrito.
Let's get a quick. We put up a little picture on Instagram to promote the thing. So
evidence.
I know. I was a Jeopardy clue today.
Are you?
Yes.
That's how you know you made it.
I'm very excited. Well, I was on Jeopardy in the 90s.
Oh, were you?
So it was very exciting
for me. On, yeah.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.